A man came down the wide stairs, holding the rail, shuffling with fatigue. He was dressed in evening wear, apart from maroon suede slippers. He came all the way down and stood up straight, and said,
"Who are you, sir?"
Reacher gave his name and told his brief story, stranded in the snow, a lighted window in a distant house, the hopes of a cup of coffee. The man introduced himself with the rank of colonel. Reacher said in the circumstances he couldn't presume to trespass on their hospitality and would leave at once. The woman said,
"Mr. Reacher was a policeman in the army."
The colonel said,
"Our army?"
"Uncle Sam," Reacher said, "half a dozen different MP units."
"I wish you'd been a medic instead."
"Is there a problem?"
"It's her first baby, and it came on fast. I imagine her doctor is having a problem getting here."
"Does her doctor know her well?"
"Has done for years."
"So he'll make an effort?"
"She. Her doctor is a woman. She'll make an effort."
"Therefore, she could be stuck somewhere," Reacher said. "She might have tried the last couple miles on foot like I did. It's about the only way."
"She'll freeze to death. What should we do?"
Reacher glanced at the window. He said, "We should wait 15 minutes, for a little more daylight. Then scan from the upstairs windows. With binoculars, if you have them. We need to look for incoming tracks that stop dead, way out there." The colonel said,
"You must have been given medical training to some degree. Our MPs seem to get plenty."
"Ours, didn't include childbirth," Reacher said. "I bet yours didn't either." The lady of the house said,
"I can't go in there. It wouldn't be appropriate."
15 minutes later, the snow was lit up gray, and all kinds of natural detail was visible for miles around. They started in the colonel's own bedroom, at a window facing west. They saw nothing. No abandoned car, no wandering footsteps getting weaker and then stopping. They set up facing north, at a window in the upstairs hallway, and saw the same nothing all over again. The wind in the night had polished the drifts to a shine, and nothing was broken. South was the same story. A blank sheet. No footprints. East was a different story. The only good view out was from what was about to become the delivery room, or the maternity ward, or whatever else you wanted to call it. Hopefully not the ICU. The colonel wouldn't go in. He said it would be unseemly. His wife had already made her position clear. So Reacher knocked politely and heard a gasped, "Come in." So he did, keeping his eyes front, explaining as he went, raising the field glasses, seeing his own tracks from earlier, curving in from the right, starting way out, coming close to the wall and in through the gate. But also seeing a second incoming track, from the opposite direction, starting level with his own, but way on the left, and then homing in with the same smooth curve, but suddenly stopping dead, some way short of the wall. A voice from the bed said,
"Have you found her?"
He said, "I think so."
"Look at me."
He did. She was a flushed brunette, squirming with discomfort, the sheet pulled up to her chin. She said,
"Go and rescue her, please. Bring her to me. I can't do this alone."
"I'm sure your stepmother would come if you really wanted her to."
"Not her. This is her fault. I saw her wearing the diamond. That was my mother's pendant. I freaked out and went into labor. Now I need help."
Reacher nodded and stepped back to the hallway. The others followed him downstairs. He said, "Get hot water ready, and blankets. The doctor could have been out there a long time." Then he set out, back along the driveway, using his previous footholds in reverse, straining from one to the next, then peeling away from the gates the other direction, in a symmetrical curve, scanning ahead to a lower horizon, battling the wind, plunging through undisturbed snow, at first seeing nothing, then seeing a shadow, and the shadow becoming a hole, and beyond it, staggering footsteps leading backward to where she had started. Two sets of footsteps, in fact. A big hole. Reacher floundered on. Saw two people lying in the snow. a woman in a parka, and a cop in a bulky yellow police jacket. Both were shivering and both had their eyes closed. Reacher rolled the cop aside and hauled the doctor into a sitting position. Her eyes blinked open. Beside her, the cop sat up. Reacher asked him, "How long have you been out here?" The guy checked his watch and said,
"Me? About 2 hours. I found her car abandoned and followed her tracks in the snow. I didn't get any further than she did."
His words were all broken up by shivering. They came out in spurts of steam. The woman was very cold. Reacher asked the cop, "How close is your vehicle?"
"Further than they asked."
"Only one choice, then. I'll carry her, and you carry her bag."
"Why is she even here? I thought a diamond was missing. Is someone injured?"
"The daughter of the house is having a baby, all by herself. And the diamond isn't missing, but we'll worry about that later."
"Who are you?"
"I was passing by. I thought they might give me a cup of coffee, or even Christmas dinner."
"Why would they?"
"I thought it might be a tradition."
What did they say?"
"They were preoccupied." Reacher lifted the woman into his arms. He stood up and turned around and set off back the way he had come. The cop floundered behind, shorter than Reacher, unable to use his pre-made footholds and therefore slower. Reacher hustled hard, trying to generate surplus body heat, pressing the doctor close, trying to transfer it to her. She was coming around slowly. Reacher pounded onward. Then she woke up the rest of the way, fast, and she started struggling in panic.
"We're on our way," Reacher panted. "She's holding out for you."
What time is it?"
"About 3 hours later than you figured it would be."
"Who are you?"
"Long story. Starts with a Dutch woman. But that part's not important now."
"Have the contractions started?"
"Little ones, maybe. But no screaming or yelling yet. But she's all alone."
"The stepmother has a phobia. I think she had a bad experience of her own."
"She said she never had kids."
"People like that usually do."
Reacher turned in at the gate and staggered for balance, and set off down the driveway, galumphing from one old footprint to the next, the policeman huffing and puffing 20 steps back. They made it to the door, which opened immediately into a flurry of hot towels and warmed blankets. Eventually, the doctor passed herself fit and hurried up the stairs. The house seemed to breathe out and relax. The colonel took up a position in the upstairs hallway, pacing back and forth in a traditional style, and about to be grandfather, just as nervous as he must have been a generation before as an about-to-be father. The about-to-be step-grandmother got herself halfway up the stairs, holding the rail all the way, and then she stopped, unable to go further. But she kept on gazing upward, just waiting. The cop joined Reacher in the back corner of the downstairs hallway and said,
"Now tell me about the diamond."
Reacher said, "It was described as a pendant. It was the first wife's, not the second. As rich as these folks are, it must have been big enough and heavy enough to notice if it's not there anymore. So she didn't lose it when they went out to dinner, which they did because they're in party clothes. And the cook left yesterday, before the snow. The daughter didn't go with them tonight. But she saw them when they got back, because there was a big hoo-ha about her mother's diamond, during which the stepmother no doubt took it off. Then, later, it's missing. And because it was a big hoo-ha, she doesn't specifically remember taking it off, so she projects backward and thinks it was lost at the dinner party, or a coat check boy stole it."
"So where is it?"
"The daughter picked it up. Her mother's diamond. Partly a defensive instinct, but mostly because she was about to have a baby all alone, and she wanted the comfort of clutching something of her mother's, like a good luck charm. They wasted your time. You'll find it in her hand or under her pillow."
"The baby's being born on Christmas Day."
"So are a third of a million others. Don't make a big deal out of it."
"Eh, you should go look in the kitchen. The cook will have prepared in advance. Well, they won't be eating today. Too nervous. You could get your Christmas dinner after all."
And Reacher did. Alone in Trout Hall's basement kitchens, while above him The others waited. Then he left. And he never found out who was born there that day. Guy walks into a bar.
She was about 19, no older, maybe younger. An insurance company would have given her 60 more years to live. I figured a more accurate projection was 36 hours, or 36 minutes, if things went wrong from the get-go. She was blonde and blue-eyed, but not American. American girls have a glow, a smoothness, for many generations of plenty. This girl was different. Her ancestors had known hardship and fear. That inheritance was in her face and her body and her movements. Her eyes were wary. Her body was lean. Not the kind of lean you get from a diet, but the Darwinian kind of lean you get when your grandparents had no food and either starved or didn't. Her movements were fragile and tense, a little alert, a little nervous, even though on the face of it, she was having as good a time as a girl could get. She was in a New York bar, drinking beer, listening to a band, and she was in love with the guitar player, that was clear. The part of her gaze that wasn't wary was filled with adoration, and it was all aimed in his direction. She was probably Russian. She was rich. She was alone at a table near the stage, and she had a pile of ATM fresh 20s in front of her, and she was paying for each new bottle with one of them, and she wasn't asking for change. The waitresses loved her. There was a guy further back in the room, wedged on an upholstered bench, staring at her, her bodyguard, presumably. He was a tall, wide man, with a shaved head and a black T-shirt under a black suit. He was a part of the reason she was drinking beer in a city bar at the age of 19 or less. It wasn't the kind of glossy place that had a policy about underage rich girls, either for or against. It was a scruffy dive on Bleecker Street, staffed by skinny kids trying to make tuition money, and I guess they had looked at her and her minder and taken a snap decision against trouble and in favor of tips. I watched her for a minute, and then I looked away. My name is Jack Reacher, and once I was a military cop, with heavy emphasis on the past tense. I've been out nearly as long as I was in, but old habits die hard. I had stepped into the bar the same way I always step anywhere, which is carefully. 1:30 in the morning. I had ridden the A train to West 4th and walked south on 6th Avenue and made the left on Bleecker and checked the sidewalks. I wanted music, but not the kind that drives large numbers of patrons outside to smoke. The smallest knot of people was next to a place with half a flight of stairs leading up to its door. There was a shiny black Mercedes sedan parked on the curb with a driver behind the wheel. The music coming out of the place was filtered and dulled by the walls, but I could hear an agile bass line and some snappy drumming. So I walked up the stairs and paid a $5 cover and shouldered my way inside. Two exits. One, the door I had just come through. The other indicated at the end of a long, dark restroom corridor, way in back. The room was narrow and about 90 feet deep. A bar on the left at the front, then some upholstered horseshoe benches, then a cluster of freestanding tables on what, on other nights, might have been a dance floor. Then the stage, with the band on it. The band looked like it had been put together by accident after a misfiling incident at a talent agency. The bass player was a stout old black guy in a suit with a vest. He was plucking away at an upright bass fiddle. The drummer could have been his uncle. He was a big old guy sprawled comfortably behind a small, simple kit. The singer was also a harmonica player, and was older than the bass player, and younger than the drummer, and bigger than either one, maybe 60, built for comfort, not for speed. The guitarist was completely different. He was young and white and small, maybe 20, maybe 5'6", maybe 130 pounds. He had a fancy blue guitar wired to a crisp new amplifier, and together the instrument and the electronics made sharp sounds full of space and echoes. The amp must have been turned up to 11. The sound was incredibly loud. It was like the air in the room was locked solid. It had no more capacity for volume. But the music was good. The three black guys were old pros, and the white kid knew all the notes, and when and how and in what order to play them. He was wearing a red T-shirt and black pants and white tennis shoes. He had a very serious expression on his face. He looked foreign, maybe Russian, too. I spent the first half of the first song checking the room, counting people, scanning faces, parsing body language. Old habits die hard. There were two guys across a table with their hands underneath it, one selling, one buying, obviously, the deal done by feel and confirmed with furtive glances. The bar staff was scamming the owner by selling store-bought beer out of an ice chest. Two out of three domestic bottles were legit, from the refrigerator cabinets, and then the third came from their own cooler. I got one of them, a wet label and a big margin. I carried the bottle to a corner seat and sat down with my back to the wall. It was at that point I saw the girl alone at her table and her bodyguard on his bench. I guessed the Mercedes outside was theirs. I guessed Daddy was a B-grade oligarch, millions but not billions, indulging his daughter with 4 years at NYU and an ATM card that never stopped working. Just two people out of 80 in the room. No big deal. Until I saw two other guys. They were a pair. Tall, young white men, cheap, tight leather jackets, heads shaved by blunt razors that had left nicks and scabs. More Russians, probably. Operators, no question. Connected, no doubt. Probably not the best the world has ever seen, but probably not the worst either. They were sitting far apart from one another, but their twin gazes were triangulated on the girl alone at the table. They were tense, determined, to some degree nervous. I recognized the signs. Many times I had felt the same way myself. They were about to go into action. So, two B-grade oligarchs had a beef, and one was protecting his kid with drivers and bodyguards, and the other was sending guys around the world to snatch her. Then would come ransom, and extortion, and demands, and fortunes would change hands, or uranium leases, or oil rights, or coal or gas. Business, Moscow style. But not usually successful business. Kidnaps have 1,000 different dynamics, and go wrong 1,000 different ways. Average life expectancy for a kidnap victim is 36 hours. Some survive, but most don't. Some die right away in the initial panic. The girl's pile of 20s was attracting waitresses like wasps at a picnic, and she wasn't shooing any of them away. She was taking one fresh bottle after another, and beer is beer. She was going to have to visit the restroom, soon and often. And the restroom corridor was long and dark, and It had a street exit at the end of it. I watched her in the gaudy, reflected light, with the music shrieking and pounding all around me. The two guys watched her. Her bodyguard watched her. She watched the guitarist. He was concentrating hard, key changes and choruses, but from time to time he would lift his head and smile, mostly at the glory of being up on the stage, but, twice, directly at the girl. The first of those smiles was shy, and the second was a little wider. The girl stood up. She butted the lip of her table with her thighs and shuffled out from behind it and headed for the corridor in back. I got there first. The sound from the band howled through it. The ladies' room was halfway down. The men's room was all the way at the end. I leaned on the wall and watched the girl walk toward me. She was up on high heels, and she was wearing tight pants, and her steps were short and precise. Not drunk yet. She was Russian. She put a pale palm on the restroom door and pushed. She went inside. Less than 10 seconds later, the two guys stepped into the corridor. I guessed they would wait there for her, but they didn't. They glanced at me like I was part of the architecture and shouldered in through the ladies' room door, one after the other. The door slammed behind them. The music played on. I went in after them. Every day brings something new. I had never been in a women's bathroom before. Stalls on the right, sinks on the left. Bright light and the smell of perfume. The girl was standing near the back wall. The two guys were facing her. Their backs were to me. I said, "Hey." But they didn't hear. Too much noise. I caught them by the elbows, one in each hand. They spun around, ready to fight, but then they stopped. I am bigger than the frigid airs they had been dreaming about back home. They stood still for a second, and then pushed past me, and pulled the door, and headed out. The girl looked at me for a moment, with an emotion I couldn't read, and then I left her to do what she needed to do. I went back to my seat. The two guys were already back in theirs. The bodyguard was impassive. He was watching the stage. The band was finishing up. The girl was still in the bathroom. The music stopped. The two guys got up and headed back toward the corridor. The room was suddenly crowded with people standing and moving. I headed over to the bodyguard and tapped him on the shoulder and pointed. He took no notice. He didn't move at all until the guitar player started backing away off the stage. Then he got up, the two movements perfectly synchronized, and I knew I had gotten it all wrong. Not an indulged daughter, an indulged son. Daddy had bought the guitar and the amp and hired backing musicians, the boy's dream, out of the bedroom, onto the stage. His driver at the curb, his bodyguard watching all the way. Not a team of two from his rival, but a team of three, an adoring groupie, the boy's dream, a classic honey trap. A last-minute tactical conference in the bathroom, and then action. I shoved my way through to the back and got to the street well ahead of the bodyguard, just as the girl was hugging the boy and turning him through a half-circle and pushing him toward the two guys. I hit the first one hard, and the second one harder, and got blood from his mouth all over my shirt. The two guys went down, and the girl fled, and then the bodyguard showed up. I made him give me his T-shirt. Bloodstains attract attention. Then I left through the front. The obvious move would have been to turn right, so I turned left, and I got the 6 train at Bleecker and Lafayette, heading north, the last but one car. I settled in and checked the faces. Old habits die hard.
No room at the motel. It was snowing when Reacher got out of the bus, in a part of America where it didn't snow often. It was late in the afternoon, and the streetlights were on. People looked both excited and anxious at the unaccustomed weather. There was about 6 inches of slushy pack on the ground, and the flurries were coming down hard. Some folks looked itching to go sledding or snowballing, and others looked convinced the power was about to go out and vehicular transportation was about to become impossible for months. Context, Reacher thought. What was a mere sprinkle by northern standards was a big deal in the south. He sloshed his way across the sidewalk to a humped patch of what he guessed was grass, like a village green with a flagpole, which had a frozen and matted stars and stripes hanging limply from it. The town was a mile from the interstate highway and knew it. It was all gas stations and fast food and inns and motels, a pit stop, nothing more, all geared to what random travelers wanted, especially that day. Already cars were pulling off and splashing through the downtown slush, searching for a place to stay an unexpected night, anything to avoid certain death in the raging blizzard ahead. Context, Reacher thought again, and melodrama. He figured he'd better snag a room before the panic turned into a rush. He had seen news video from time to time of stranded travelers sprawled in motel lobbies, no room at the inn, which made him remember it was Christmas Eve, December 24th. He chose the cheapest-looking place, which was a falling-down motel next to a Shell station big enough for 18-wheel trucks. It was a 12-room dump, with 10 already taken, which made Reacher think maybe the rush had already started. The place could have been no one's first choice. It wasn't the Ritz, that was for sure. He paid cash and got a key and walked along the row to his room, all hunched under his collar to ward off the blowing snow. 10 rooms had cars parked outside, all rimed with snow and streaked with salt, all with plates from states to the south, all laden with luggage and packages. Families, Reacher guessed, aiming to get together for the holidays, their journeys interrupted, their plans ruined, their gifts undelivered. He unlocked his door and stepped into his room, which looked adequate in every respect. There was a bed and a bathroom, even a chair. He shook meltwater off his shoes and sat down, and watched the flurries through a fogged window as they whirled through yellow halos of vapor light. He figured drivers would be chickening out in waves, but they would look for accommodation first, not food, which meant the diners wouldn't crowd out for another couple of hours. He switched on the bedside light and took a paperback book from his pocket. 90 minutes later, he was in a diner, waiting for a cheeseburger. The place was filling up, and service was slow. There was a kind of manic energy in the room, from a lot of forced high spirits. Folks were trying to convince themselves they were having an adventure. Eventually his food came and he ate. The place got more and more crowded. People were coming in and just standing there, somehow defeated. The motels were full, Reacher realized. No more room at the inn. People were eyeing the diner floor, like in the news footage. He ordered peach pie and black coffee and settled in to wait for it. He walked back to the motel pretty late in the evening. The snow was still coming down, but lighter. Tomorrow would be a better day. He turned in at the motel office and stopped short to avoid walking straight into a very pregnant woman. She was with a guy, huddled aimlessly, and she had been crying. An idling car stood by, an old three-door, rimed with snow and streaked with salt, and full of luggage and packages. No room at the inn. Reacher said, "Are you guys okay?" The man said nothing, and the woman said,
"Not exactly."
"Can't get a room?"
"The whole town is full."
"Should have kept on going," Reacher said. "The weather's letting up."
"I made him pull off. I was worried."
"So what do you plan to do?" The woman didn't answer, and the man said, "I guess we'll sleep in the car." "You'll freeze." "What choice do we have?" Reacher said, When is the baby due?
Soon.
Reacher said, I'll trade.
What for what?
I'll sleep in your car, and you can have my room.
We can't let you do that.
I've slept in cars before, but never while pregnant. I imagine that wouldn't be easy.
Neither the man nor the woman spoke. Reacher took his key out of his pocket and said,
Take it or leave it.
The woman said, You'll freeze.
I'll be just fine.
And then they all stood around for a minute more, shuffling in the cold. But soon enough, the woman took the key, and she and her partner crabbed away to the room, a little embarrassed, but basically very happy, wanting to look back but not letting themselves. Reacher called a happy Christmas after them, and they turned and wished him the same. Then they went inside, and Reacher turned away. He didn't sleep in their car. He walked over to the Shell station instead, and found a guy with a tanker with 5,000 gallons of milk in it, which had a use-by date, and the weather was clearing. The guy was willing to go for it, and Reacher went with him. The Picture of the Lonely Diner. Jack Reacher got out of the R train at 23rd Street and found the nearest stairway blocked off with plastic police tape. It was striped blue and white, tied between one handrail and the other, and it was moving in the subway wind, and it said, Police, do not enter, which technically Reacher didn't want to do anyway. He wanted to exit, although to exit, he would need to enter the stairwell, which was a linguistic complexity, in which context he sympathized with the cops. They didn't have different kinds of tape for different kinds of situation. Police do not enter in order to exit was not in their inventory. So Reacher turned around and hiked half the length of the platform to the next stairway, which was also taped off, Police do not enter, blue and white, fluttering gently in the last of the departing train's slipstream, which was odd. He was prepared to believe the first stairway might have been the site of a singular peril, maybe a chunk of fallen concrete, or a buckled nose on a crucial step, or some other hazard to life and limb. But not both stairways, not both at once. What were the odds? So maybe the sidewalk above was the problem. A whole block's length. Maybe there had been a car wreck, or a bus wreck, or a suicide from a high window above, or a drive-by shooting, or a bomb. Maybe the sidewalk was slick with blood and littered with body parts, or auto parts, or both. Reacher half turned and looked across the track. The exit directly opposite was taped off, and the next. All the exits were taped off. Blue and white, Police do not enter. No way out, which was an issue. The Broadway local was a fine line, and the 23rd Street station was a fine example of its type,
and Reacher had many times slept in far worse places, but he had things to do, and not much time to do them in. He walked back to the first stairway he had tried, and he ducked under the tape. He was cautious up the stairs, craning his neck, looking ahead, and especially looking upward, but seeing nothing untoward. No loose rebar, no fallen concrete, no damaged steps, no thin rivulets of blood, no spattered fragments of flesh on the tile. Nothing. He stopped on the stairs with his nose level with the 23rd Street sidewalk, and he scanned left and right. Nothing. He stepped up one stair, and turned around and looked across Broadway's humped blacktop at the Flatiron Building, his destination. He looked left and right. He saw nothing. He saw less than nothing. No cars, no taxis, no buses, no trucks, no scurrying panel vans with their business names hastily handwritten on their doors. No motorbikes, no Vespa scooters in pastel colors, no delivery men on bikes from restaurants or messenger services, no skateboarders, no rollerbladers, no pedestrians. It was summer, close to 11 at night, and still warm. Fifth Avenue was crossing Broadway right in front of him. Dead ahead was Chelsea. Behind him was Gramercy. To his left was Union Square, and to his right the Empire State Building loomed over the scene like the implacable monolith it was. He should have seen 100 people, or 1,000, or 10,000. Guys in canvas shoes and T-shirts, girls in short summer dresses, some of them strolling, some of them hustling to clubs about to open their doors, or bars with the latest vodka, or midnight movies. There should have been a whole big crowd. There should have been laughter and conversation and shuffling feet and the kind of hoots and yelps a happy crowd makes at 11 o'clock on a warm summer's evening, and sirens and car horns and the whisper of tires and the roar of engines. There was nothing. Reacher went back down the stairs and under the tape again. He walked underground, north, to the site of his second attempt, and this time he stepped over the tape, because it was slung lower. He went up the stairs just as cautiously, but faster, now right on the street corner, with Madison Square Park ahead of him, fenced in black iron and packed with dark trees. But its gates were still open. Not that anyone was strolling in or strolling out. There was no one around, not a soul. He stepped up to the sidewalk and stayed close to the railing around the subway stairhead. A long block to the west, he saw flashing lights, blue and red. A police cruiser was parked sideways across the street. A roadblock. Do not enter. Reacher turned and looked east. Same situation. Red and blue lights all the way over on Park Avenue. Do not enter. 23rd Street was closed, as were plenty of other cross streets, no doubt. And Broadway and Fifth Avenue and Madison, too, presumably, at about 30th Street. No one around. Reacher looked at the Flatiron Building, a narrow triangle, sharp at the front, like a thin wedge or a modest slice of cake. But to him, it looked most like the prow of a ship, like an immense ocean liner moving slowly towards him. Not an original thought. He knew many people felt the same way. Even with the cowcatcher glass house on the front ground floor, which some said ruined the effect, but which he thought added to it, because it looked like the protruding underwater bulge on the front of a supertanker, visible only when the vessel was lightly loaded. Now he saw a person. Through two panes of the cowcatcher's windows, a woman. She was standing on the Fifth Avenue sidewalk, staring north. She was wearing dark pants and a dark short-sleeved shirt. She had something in her right hand, maybe a phone, maybe a Glock 19. Reacher pushed off the subway railing and crossed the street. Against the light, technically, but there was no traffic. It was like walking through a ghost town, like being the last human on Earth, apart from the woman on Fifth Avenue, who he headed for. He aimed at the point of the cowcatcher. His heels were loud in the silence. The cowcatcher had a triangular iron frame, a miniature version of the shape it was backing up against, like a tiny sailboat trying to outrun the liner chasing it. The frame was painted green, like moss, and it had gingerbread curlicues here and there. And what wasn't metal was glass, whole panels of it, as long as cars, and tall, from above a person's head to his knees. The woman saw him coming. She turned in his direction, but backed off, as if to draw him towards her. Reacher understood. She wanted to pull him south into the shadows. He rounded the point of the cowcatcher. It was a phone in her hand, not a gun. She said, "Who are you?" He said, "Who's asking?" She turned her back and then straightened again, one fast, fluid movement, like a fake-out on the basketball court, but enough for him to see FBI in yellow letters on the back of her shirt. "Now answer my question," she said.
"I'm just a guy."
"Doing what?"
"Looking at this building."
"The Flatiron?"
"No, this part in front, the glass part."
"Why?"
Reacher said, "Have I been asleep for a long time?"
The woman said, "Meaning what?"
"Did some crazy old colonel stage a coup d'etat? Are we living in a police state now? I must have blinked and missed it."
"I'm a federal agent. I'm entitled to ask for your name and ID."
"My name is Jack Reacher, no middle initial. I have a passport in my pocket. You want me to take it out?"
"Very slowly."
So he did, very slowly. He used scissored fingers, like a pickpocket, and drew out the slim blue booklet and held it away from his body, long enough for her to register what it was, and then he passed it to her, and she opened it. She said,
"Why were you born in Berlin?"
He said, "I had no control over my mother's movements. I was just a fetus at the time."
"Why was she in Berlin?"
"Because my father was. We were a Marine family. She said I was nearly born on a plane."
"Are you a Marine?"
"I'm unemployed at the moment."
"After being what?"
"Unemployed for many previous moments."
"After being what?"
"Army."
"Branch?"
"Military police."
She handed back the passport. She said,
"Rank?"
He said,
"Does it matter?"
"I'm entitled to ask." She was looking past his shoulder. He said,
"I was terminal at major."
"Is that good or bad?"
"Bad, mostly. If I had been any good at being a major, they would have made me stay."
She didn't reply. He said,
"What about you?"
"What about me?"
"Rank?"
"Special agent in charge."
"Are you in charge tonight?"
"Yes, I am."
"Outstanding."
She said, "Where did you come from?"
He said, "The subway."
"Was there police tape?"
"I don't recall."
"You broke through it."
"Check the First Amendment. I'm pretty sure I'm allowed to walk around where I want. Isn't that part of what makes America great?"
"You're in the way."
"Of what?"
She was still looking past his shoulder. She said, "I can't tell you."
"Then you should have told the train not to stop. Tape isn't enough."
"I didn't have time."
"Because?"
"I can't tell you." Reacher said nothing. The woman said, "What's your interest in the glass part of this building?"
Reacher said, "I'm thinking of putting in a bid as a window washer. Might get me back on my feet."
"Lying to a federal agent is a felony."
"A million people every day look in these windows. Have you asked them?"
"I'm asking you."
Reacher said, "I think Edward Hopper painted Nighthawks here."
"Which is what?"
"A painting. Quite famous. Looking in through a diner's windows, late at night, at the lonely people inside."
"I never heard of a diner called Nighthawks. Not here."
"The Nighthawks were the people. The diner was called Phillies."
"I never heard of a diner here called anything."
"I don't think there was one."
"You just said there was."
"I think Hopper saw this place and made it a diner in his head, or a lunch counter, at least. The shape is exactly the same, looked at from right where we're standing now."
"Ah, I think I know that picture. Three people, isn't it?"
"Plus the counterman. He's kind of bent over, doing something in the well. There are two coffee urns behind him."
"First there's a couple, close but not touching, and then one lonely guy all by himself, with his back to us, in a hat."
"All the men wear hats."
"The woman is a redhead.
She looks sad. It's the loneliest picture I've ever seen.
Reacher looked through the real-life glass. Easy to imagine bright fluorescent light in there, pinning people like searchlight beams, exposing them in a merciless way to the dark streets all around. Except the streets all around were empty, so there was no one to see. In the painting, and in real life, too. He said, "What have I walked into?" The woman said, "You're to stand still, right where you are, and don't move until I tell you to."
"Or what?"
"Or you'll go to prison for interfering with a national security operation."
"Or you'll get fired for continuing with a national security operation after it suddenly got a civilian in the way."
"The operation isn't here. It's in the park."
She looked diagonally across the wide junction, three major thoroughfares, all meeting, at the mass of trees beyond. He said, "What have I walked into?" She said, "I can't tell you."
"I'm sure I've heard worse."
"Military police, right?"
"Like the FBI, but on a much lower budget."
"We have a target in the park, sitting on a bench, all alone, waiting for a contact who isn't coming."
"Who is he?"
"A bad apple."
"From your barrel?"
She nodded. "One of us."
"Is he armed?"
"He's never armed."
"Why isn't his contact coming?"
"He died an hour ago in a hit-and-run accident. The driver didn't stop. No one got the plate."
"There's a big surprise."
"He turned out to be Russian. The State Department had to inform their consulate, which turned out to be where the guy worked, purely by coincidence."
"Your guy was talking to the Russians? Do people still do that?"
"More and more. And it's getting more and more important all the time. People say we're headed back to the 1980s, but they're wrong. We're headed back to the 1930s.
"So your guy ain't gonna win Employee of the Month."
She didn't answer. He said,
"Where are you gonna take him?"
She paused a beat. She said, "All that's classified."
"All that? All what? He can't be going to multiple destinations."
She didn't answer. Now he paused a beat. He said,
"Is he headed for the destination you want?"
She didn't answer.
"Is he?"
She said, "No."
"Because of suits higher up?"
"As always."
"Are you married?"
"What's that got to do with anything?"
"Are you?"
"I'm hanging in there."
"So, you're the redhead."
"And?"
"I'm the guy in the hat with his back to us, all alone."
"Meaning what?"
"Meaning, I'm gonna take a walk, like a First Amendment thing. Meaning you're gonna stay here, like a smart tactical thing."
And he turned and moved away, before she had a chance to object. He rounded the tip of the cowcatcher and headed diagonally across the heart of the complex junction, moving fast, not breaking stride at the curbs and the painted lines, ignoring the don't walk signs, not slowing at all, and finally straight into the park itself, by its southwest gate. Ahead was a dry fountain and a closed-up burger stall. Curving left was the main center path, clearly following some kind of a design scheme that featured large ovals, like running tracks. There were dim, fancy lights on poles, and the Times Square glow was bouncing off the clouds like a magnesium flare. Reacher could see pretty well, but all he saw were empty benches, at least at the start of the curve. More came into sight as he walked, but they too stayed empty, all the way to the far tip of the oval, where there was another dry fountain and a children's playground, and finally the continuation of the path itself, curving down the other side of the oval, back towards the near tip, and it had benches too, and one of them was occupied. By a big guy, all pink and fleshy, maybe 50 years old, in a dark suit, a pouchy face and thinning hair, a guy who looked like his life had passed him by. Reacher stepped close, and the guy looked up, and then he looked away. But Reacher sat down next to him anyway. He said,
"Boris, or Vladimir, or whatever his name was, isn't coming.
You're busted. They know you're not armed. But they've gone ahead and cleared about 20 square blocks, which means they're going to shoot you. You're about to be executed. But not while I'm here. Not with witnesses. And as it happens, the SAC isn't happy with it. But she's getting pressure from above. The guy said,
"So?"
Reacher said, "So here's my good deed of the day. If you want to turn yourself into her, I'll walk with you, every step of the way. You can tell her what you know, and you can get 3 squares a day in prison the rest of your life." The guy didn't answer. Reacher said, "But maybe you don't want to go to prison the rest of your life. Maybe you're shamed. Maybe suicide by cop is better. Who am I to judge? So my super good deed of the day is to walk away if you tell me to. Your choice." The guy said,
"Then walk away."
"You sure?"
"I can't face it."
"Why did you do it?"
"To be somebody."
"What kind of stuff could you tell the SAC?
"Nothing important. Damage assessment is their main priority, but they already know what I had access to, so they already know what I told them."
"And you've got nothing worthwhile to add?"
"Not a thing."
"I don't know anything. My contacts aren't stupid. They know this can happen."
"Okay," Reacher said. "I'll walk away."
And he did, out of the park in its northeast corner, where he heard faint radio chatter in the shadows announcing his departure, and a deserted block up Madison Avenue, where he waited against the limestone base of a substantial building. 4 minutes later, he heard suppressed handguns, 11 or 12 rounds expended, a volley of thudding percussions, like phone books slammed on desks. Then he heard nothing more. He pushed off the wall and walked north on Madison, imagining himself back at the lunch counter, his hat in place, his elbows drawn in, nursing a new secret in a life already full of old secrets.
No Middle Name is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Penguin Random House Group. Copyright Lee Child, 2017. Copyright in recording, Random House Audiobooks. Lee Child has asserted his right under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988 to be identified as the author of this work.